Welcome to the third series of the Reworked podcast,
brought to you by diversity consultancy EW Group. I'm Rachel Wilson, and every fortnight I'll be speaking to CEOs, HR leaders, and workplace activists about the steps they are taking to reform and rework organisational culture.
So today I'm at Cushman & Wakefield speaking to Len Montgomery, who is the Diversity and Inclusion Manager here and has been since April, just April of this year. Len's background, well, I think your career in diversity and inclusion really probably started at Stonewall and then moved then to Sainsbury's, which I want to talk to you about as a D&I executive, and then more recently to Cushman & Wakefield, who are a property development company based in the City of London, a client of EW Groups as well, actually. We've been running inclusive leadership training here throughout most of 2018 with the executive committee and senior leaders. So I know a bit about Cushman & Wakefield, but we'll probably come on to the current position. I know, Len, you're very comfortable talking about your trans identity. You've got a really popular TEDx talk online, which a lot of people I'm sure will have seen, and I'll link to that from my episode notes as well. You said in that TED talk that you felt a lot of love and support during the time you were transitioning, and that one of the hardest things actually for you was around the workplace and finding a job. So maybe can we sort of start there and tell us a little bit of your sort of potted career history, how you came into maybe into D&I through into Sainsbury's and into Cushman & Wakefield to bring us up to the present?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, thanks for having me. And it's nice to be sort of talking about one of my favourite things, which is work, actually. So it's something I did talk about in my TED talk quite a lot, is that employment and workforce, I'd say that's like the biggest barrier I've had since transitioning. Because this year I'm celebrating 10 years of transitioning.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Which is quite weird, telling people that you're 10 years old. I'm just like, no, I am over 18. My right to work documents are okay, you know, sort of. But I know it's a city and no one's going up any chimneys or anything like that. But it was actually something that I really underestimated, to be entirely honest. You know, sort of because, yes, there are certain social areas of exclusion that I faced, and there has been some. You know, it hasn't always been a walk in the park. However, I have had a lot of allies, I've had a lot of love, I've had a lot of support. But with employment, I was like, oh my goodness. And also, to me, it started to explain, or it helped answer a few questions, perhaps, as to maybe why this is why people transition when they're a bit older. Or maybe this is why people have such a job fear, because I've heard people say it's going to be really hard to keep or maintain a career. And from transitioning, you know, so obviously when I started, I was working, fortunately, in a startup sort of based environment, so that was okay. But then when I left that and decided to start pursuing other types of work, predominantly I first started off, when I went to university, which again, I went a little bit later, partly because I was brought up on benefits for a lot of my life, and then I was given an opportunity by someone to go to university that gave me some of the money towards fees, so I was very privileged and very lucky to have that. And it was during that time that I decided that I would transition, which the first hurdle was actually my actual university. They refused, even though I had my name change documents, because I was in my final year, they refused to change anything over for me. So I still had to have my student pass and everything else. Mm. All my degree certificates are still in my old name, but I could pay a lot of extra money to have it changed over. But again, I just found that already wasn't something that I felt comfortable with. Well, the first indicator of something's a bit wrong is what I've discovered, and what still sadly is the case now, is that if people don't understand someone that's trans or trans identity, they think they've got the right to be incredibly rude to you and really, really, not just obstructive, but really unhelpful. And it's the attitude of, well, you people, or, you know, sort of, and it's those kind of things that come up. Anyway, I did start to apply for more roles, because post the startup and things like that, I was doing more sort of social media communications work, and that's where a lot of my background actually lies in. But then, during that time, I found interesting with diversity monitoring forms and things like that, the more open I was in applications about who I was, I was just not getting any responses, or just flat-out rejections. But then I started to keep a detailed spreadsheet of this stuff, because part of me is I really don't like Excel very much, but actually the one thing that I was trying to prove to myself or demonstrate to myself is I did not want there to become this ism happening in myself, of feeling like, is this because I'm trans?
Mm.
Because actually everything else in my life, I was having such a positive experience and I was having such a lot of acceptance and lots of love and like things that, you know, that I was, and I'm not someone that has that, you know, firstly, I don't like a sort of, for myself anyway, you know, I don't feel that I have a very victim mentality with myself. And I thought, I'm not having that. But the more I was analysing this, the more I was like, this is really weird. And when I did get interviews on some occasions, it was always the times that I basically didn't say I was trans, or even at times where I didn't even disclose that I was LGBT, or even that I was white other. I would just tick white because I'm mixed race, but I look Italian, you know, but I don't look anything like my actual ethnic background, which is Afro-Caribbean, Asian and white. And I found that was interesting too, because I realised on two fronts that perhaps I was hitting, there were two biases that were flashing up there. Mm. First bias, I don't have a very English sounding name, Len Montgomery. I realised first name doesn't sound, and a lot of people in some interviews actually said they thought I'd be Chinese or Southeast Asian or something like that, when in fact I'm not. That actually did used to be my surname. So, and then the other front is obviously the trans identity, because in some instances people thought I was just about to start having a transition, and I think the employer felt potentially exposed because they didn't have a transitioning policy in place.
Right.
They also didn't understand that trans males existed, so there was also this, they would ask me when I was going to start having a more female identity and stuff like that. Again, that I had to explain that wasn't the case, and then there was just all this awkwardness that would emerge. So in one instance I was asked, you know, well, what toilet would you use, or people would, or I'd be told that I was giving a great interview until I'd mentioned anything around that, and then suddenly there was questions about culture fit or those sorts of comebacks, which is always, I think, is quite a finessing term for saying basically you don't fit in here or we don't want you, and that's kind of what's coming out. But basically over a 3-year period I had like 280 rejections.
Wow.
And that's when I thought there is something going on here.
And but it's classic though, isn't it, for any minority group person, to actually your first instinct was actually to interrogate that and just be, is this just my assumption, or is this actually playing out? And actually you put it on yourself first and foremost, didn't you? It's like,
absolutely. First thing that really primed me into thinking, you know what, I think I need to switch career, was actually when I changed my name with my bank. My bank was outrageous. It was a point that I ended up with compensation, because the conversation, again, this is an example actually on D&I front, why frontline training I think is so, so necessary right now.
Right.
Because, you know, I brought in all the documents I was meant to bring in. I also asked for privacy because, you know, I sort of thought this isn't just a standard name change. That was denied to me. So in my bank, and in a lot of banks now, the customer service areas are incredibly open plan.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of cafe feel.
Yeah.
Well, when you're about to talk about having a gender change, or, you know, that is really not a nice environment to be in. And especially when someone that knows nothing about it. So in a nutshell, because I'm conscious of time, the person at first firstly told me that I didn't even look like a man. I was also asked if I still had friends. Does my family accept me? And do I have a partner? Because they could never go out with someone like me. They also pointed at my groin and asked me if I'd had the surgery. And just kept going. And I just kept trying to refer them back to what was relevant. And then, just to make that tiny bit more awkward, they actually called across to another colleague that was dealing with another customer and asked if there was a trans person in said branch. So at that point, everyone was looking at me and everyone was very aware of this. I relayed this to my friend who works in law, and they helped me write a very, very stiffly worded, because when I came away from that, I thought, this is wrong, something's been breached here.
Yeah.
And actually, there were many points that were breached. And also, from my letter that I gave them, it was very inclusive, actually, because I pointed out it wasn't just about trans issues that had been breached there. You know, people could ask for privacy for a number of reasons. And it was from there that I thought, with influencing and how we talk about inclusion, we have to be more open, because actually, in so many areas, or we have to be a bit more intersectional when we think about things, because certain types of discrimination that can happen, or sort of bad customer service or bad client relations actually can impact lots of different groups of people. Mm. Like, for example, in a setting like that, you can ask for privacy for a number of reasons.
Mm.
You could be going through a bereavement. Mm. You might need a slightly quieter place because of an access requirement.
All sorts of things.
And the other stuff in there, and in the end, yes, I got some compensation.
Mm.
I think partly because if that would have hit press and things like that, that would have been quite scandalised. And, you know, I was assured that the colleague had been disciplined, and I know that going forward that this organisation have been, you know, it's funny now they do very well in things like Stonewall's Workplace Equality Index and things like that, but I think this was, you know, going back like 7 years ago where I think people, a bit to what I was saying before, you know, there is still that kind of underlying, oh, if you're trans, I can talk to you like you're second class.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think people have to look at. But the other thing that now I challenge employers to do now, because I think within trans inclusion it has really, really increased as we're going along, I definitely see more policies in place, which is also quite helpful, because off the back of that, the person who did work for a law firm just said, because I said about other things that should be reformed, and in the end they sort of brokered me to sort of work with them a little bit, and we sort of looked at some of their trans inclusion and what that would look like. And from that I started to do bits of consulting or sort of advice. I also volunteered in a lot of schools with diversity role models, so I met people there, and so...
And that's kind of how you've ended up finding your way into...
Yeah, because from there people said that I could public speak very well, or I could inspire people, and the irony when I was in the schools, when I couldn't get a job, was I was at my most depressed actually, but I just needed to find purpose every day, and that's what I did.
The kind of botched university bureaucracy that you experienced 10 years ago, the bank, I hope they aren't still your bank, but your ex-bank, that was, 7 years ago. Do you have a sense that things have changed over that time?
The thing is, things actually have. But, you know, but then at the moment, there are things that are going, that very potentially, and also right now in some ways, are going backwards quite rapidly. But the good thing is that I think that places of employment, particularly if I'm talking from a trans inclusion perspective, trans actually is on the agenda now a lot more than ever it was. So actually, in terms of policies, I think it's really good to know that actually most employers, in most cases, do have some sort of transitioning at work guidance, or at least a policy in place. So there isn't such, so, you know, someone transitioning doesn't become what I call the HR hot potato, where it's like, oh great, we've just found out someone's transitioning, like, uh-oh.
And now we have to use our policy.
And then someone in HR is like, oh God, who's going to get it? And if you're the diversity person, it's just like, can you stop bringing me these things? You know, sort of that, you know, and, you know, because I think that diversity should be working with other nodes, but, you know, there should be functionality in there. Because, for example, if someone tomorrow was going to go on maternity leave, well, that wouldn't really be relevant to my job, you know, unless we're talking about the inclusion, about how we're talking about how a parent is, for example, then that's a difference.
But,
but a lot of companies, I think, now have got to a point where I feel that they definitely sort of know what to do if someone is going to transition, or if they have a non-binary identity, which I think actually is something that needs to be considered and looked at a little bit more, because it is different to transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, for example, I'm a sort of binary trans person, so, you know, for me it's really important that he and him pronouns are used, and I'm referred to and identified as a man, you know, because that's how I feel, and that's how I look as well, you know, so, you know, that's sort of who I am, but someone else might feel a bit differently. But I think the main challenge, and I've said it in my TED and I keep saying it over and over again, is that now I think for organisations that feel that they really are really quite ahead on their trans inclusive journey, and there are some organisations that are doing some brilliant work, you know, I see a lot of visibility with trans flags, non-binary flags, not just at pride parades but when there are certain awareness weeks, but my unhelpful statement will be to not to start patting yourselves on the back too early on this, because that's the biggest thing that I've found from my own experience and from many, many other people's experiences that have transitioned in the last few years in particular, have been, you know, how many people can you count that you've brought from the outside in that are trans into your organisation, and not given them the most lowest paid or most junior position in that company or that division for what it is, because I would really welcome at some point in the next few years for there to be an LGBT pay gap done.
Mm-hmm.
I know some organisations have started to look at that a bit, and I know with some recent results that came out, there was a rough estimation that there's about 16% in some circles that have been discussed. However, with trans people, I'd be very curious about that, because some people that were very senior in their roles before transition sometimes have not ever got back into that kind of role or gone past that sort of band. Mm. So it's almost like there is a ceiling. And for many people that are trans, as I said, and I've found that in some of my experiences, sometimes, you know, we have found ourselves in the lowest paid band or in the lowest position in terms of power in an organisation. And I feel that there is, if anything, it's a wasted opportunity for talent.
Absolutely.
You know, that's untapped talent that we could be having, because typically as well, because of some of the barriers that trans people face, I know for myself, I don't necessarily want to be someone that moves job all the time because of the whole having to start again and all the other areas. But also for people that have been supported really well through their transition, they're more likely to stay for a long time, or they'll remain. So actually in that instance, it's really good if you're thinking from a retention perspective, you know, that investment or having a bit more inclusion going on, especially in terms of just how your systems operate, is really important. Because I think if our systems can cope with someone getting married and they have a change of name, well, that's kind of what happens with transition. It's just that sometimes a gender marker might move or their prefix might change, because some people might have MX, for example. But it's just a case of, in this huge technological age that we live in now, in a lot of cases, all we're really asking for to be more inclusive is to add another drop down.
Yeah.
And it's how hard is that to really ask for, really?
Absolutely. When you put it like that, I mean, come on, everyone, let's move the dial on this. So we've got a lot of, as you say, a lot of organisations, trans is on the agenda, policies are emerging, if not in place. What I'd really love to talk about with you, Leng, is some ideas for what businesses can do next to really bring this trans inclusion piece to life, I guess. You know, you mentioned desired pronouns, and I noticed on your email footer you have yours clearly displayed for anybody who wants to check.
Absolutely. And also on the point,
is that a sort of thing you think organisations should be doing?
Well, on the point of the email pronouns, I've had quite a bit of feedback on that, but also I've found more people in my company and other companies actually that I've interacted with have adopted that. And it's not, and the other thing that's interesting, this is for a point of inclusion as well, because it's not just about gender identity. Actually, quite a lot of colleagues that I've spoken to that actually don't have very English sounding names, for example, have said they've sometimes thought it's helpful for them to have pronoun footers as well, you know, because sometimes people A, don't know how to pronounce their name, or they definitely can't always identify the gender. And sometimes people have been a little bit frustrated that are perhaps cisgender about being called sir or madam in the wrong way. You know, they've shared that frustration. And so, you know, to the point
equally
on that,
valid,
all I'd say is that that's not just a trans-specific thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about some of these inclusion points or some of these things that people are using. Because I think really, you know, the whole question about even asking pronouns, I mean, some people will say, what pronouns do you like to be referred to? I find just softening it to, how do you like to be addressed?
Yeah.
That's a really open question, because, for example, if there are women of certain ages that don't want to be called Mrs. or Miss, you know, there's that kind of area. Mm. But by having a more open question and accepting that if you ask how do you like to be addressed, that people could then meet you halfway, they can then tell you those sorts of pieces of information, I think that's really helpful. And it's just another point of inclusion. That's all it is in a lot of cases. So I know that some people get a bit wound up about it or go, well, I'm clearly a woman, so why am I telling everyone I am? Or, you know, that sort of attitude. But actually it's like, great, but actually some people are maybe a bit more androgynous, or their gender maybe a bit more fluid. And actually the fact is, if someone wants to tell us how they are, or if someone's basically asking you certain questions because they're trying to be respectful and inclusive to you, then I don't see what the big problem is, apart from it's just, it's a question that you've probably never had to answer so far, or you've thought about, and that's probably what's challenging to someone.
I love that point. Thank you. You know, what a nice, open, friendly, inclusive question that is to anybody. How do you like to be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I often joke with people saying, if you can't pronounce my name or can't even remember my name, you can just call me darling. You know, like, that's fine. You know, but, you know, that's the thing. I will add that to things to people. You know,
Great. Okay, well, that's definitely one thing to note down. So, what else have you got in your toolbox?
Well, I think other things that we should be doing as well, I think, if especially if you are in a company that has, or a role in a company that has sort of hiring responsibilities, is really, really make sure you have an inclusive recruitment program in place,
yeah.
or at least some certain behaviours, or at least start with some questions. Because with those questions, that can start holding people to account. Because I think, for example, if let's say you are using search or recruitment agencies or anything like that, definitely ask them quite strict questions about shortlists, because I think that's something that, again, it's my point of inclusion. It's not just about trans, it's about lots of different areas. Because if there are certain demographics or certain people not quite making the cut, ask them why, especially if you're likely to have to pay them a large fee if you then onboard someone. But if, you know, because actually they are, you can ask people and hold them to account. It's also not to tokenise, because there have been many, many cases, but on a trans-specific note, there's been many cases where sometimes some recruiters have been guilty of not shortlisting people, or actually telling clients, because this has come from some other clients I've spoken to before, where they said, oh, we had this great candidate, but she's a trans woman, so I don't think she'll fit in. And instantly, you know, and if ever anything like that ever comes up, that is where it's, I think, the employer's responsibility, if you are a really inclusive company, to say, oi,
call that out.
Or actually, I want this person to come in for an interview, because even if that person doesn't succeed, I think it's really, really important that people don't make assumptions for you, because that's something that I think holds back recruitment as well.
If a recruiter is saying that to a client, then I would say the client needs to also be looking at themselves, say, what relationship do I have with this recruiter? How do they not understand our
Absolutely.
Inclusion goals, so that they feel it's okay to come into the room and say that?
Absolutely.
But it does come back, that's the inclusive recruitment process comes back to our shared love of data, doesn't it? So you,
yes.
Excel, I don't really love Excel spreadsheets either, but I do love the data. So, that's really the key to understanding what's going on, isn't it? And unlocking some insights into how to make that process more inclusive.
Absolutely. And actually, on the subject of data, I mean, I think another thing that's really, really important to know is that quite typically, you know, because we rely on data to give us insights in terms of what's already happening in our employee population.
Mm.
But actually, we do have to think about our future employee population.
Mm.
Now, you know, with more millennials and with more sort of like the remaining, I've run out of letters almost for whatever gen it is now, you know, it's probably like 2 point whatever, you know, sort of coming in. But, you know, there are more people now that aren't always identifying with the gender they're assigned at birth and things like that. And also more people are adopting more of a non-binary or more gender neutral status. So actually having those fields is really helpful. And also, if you have them in the recruitment process in the first instance, or at least with your first touch points in terms of forms, where you need to have gender identity, I should also add, because sometimes there are some areas where gender is not really relevant in forms, so I think actually have a look at that. But particularly on forms where if you're going to be obtaining certain pieces of data for people, it's really important that I think you are quite inclusive, because that can give you a good insight. I think from a recruitment perspective, actually, the better data fields you have of people who are initially starting an application process, you can also track the success of that. And actually, that's a really good way of a company being able to look at, are there some hotspots? Is there some unconscious bias going on? Or is there an issue with attraction? Because sometimes, you know, I've worked in companies before where we've had great attraction for certain roles, where it was really quite positive to see, you know, seeing like sort of more ethnic people from ethnic backgrounds, seeing more women applying for certain roles in areas of the business that traditionally were a bit male and white. But then the interesting thing has been when it comes to the drop-off, you know, being like, wow, so they're getting to first round interview, but then they're disappearing again.
Yeah.
Or if promotion rounds and stuff like that, you know, those pieces of data, and that's why the diversity information attached can be very, very helpful.
Mm.
It can also be if you're doing all staff engagement surveys or satisfaction surveys to have an area on diversity, because it might be that there are particular demographics or certain groups that are being more impacted or feeling certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And those surveys are a great way of taking a temperature check and being able to establish, okay, clearly we're doing everything right for this group of people, but there's a certain group of people that feel really alienated or don't feel so satisfied or feel very connected to the organisation. And, you know, so I think those points are really important to look at.
Are those insights that you're gathering here at Cushman & Wakefield?
Yeah, we do ask those certain things, and also just expanding what we sort of have as well. Now, on the subject of that, yes, in a global company, I mean, this is where things are a bit different. I mean, sort of, I've had a very UK perspective for a long time, although I have worked with global companies. But I think it's really, really important to just, especially with data, and it's something that I think happens anywhere in the world, be really, really clear and transparent about what's going on with that data and what you're doing with it. Because otherwise, no one is going to want to speak to you or respond. And also some place, you know, you may get some people that feel there's a risk that you might be breaking a law in certain areas as well, and that kind of stuff. Well, and the fact is, in terms of law with data and companies, you know, as a rule of thumb, as long as you give people the option to opt out, and in many cases it's a case of mandatory data gathering of certain their protected characteristics might be illegal, but as long as people can opt out or even have a prefer not to say. And I think for certain, if it is a sort of area that might be a bit sensitive to certain areas culturally, it's just about applying that judgment. But I still think it shouldn't be getting in the way of a company's overall inclusion aim.
Because
I still think there is a big thing. It's very important, I think, to know your people. And ultimately with data, my rule of thumb with gathering and sort of asking questions is that if you don't ask, you don't get. Another tip I'll give to businesses as well is really to make sure on its websites to talk more about its values and its diversity stance as well, because obviously if you want to attract a more diverse pool of people, it really helps if there's that information on the website.
Yes, absolutely.
Or at least no understanding if you have any programs. Like here in the UK, for Cushman & Wakefield, we have an Inspire program, which is brilliant because it's made up of 6 different pillars, which covers sort of LGBT, gender, well-being, work-life solutions. We have a socio-economic group, ethnicity, and, you know, sort of within all of those nodes together. And obviously we've got LGBT as well, you know, sort of it's like really good together to have everything speaking to one another. And also as a result, they stand up as each other's allies as well.
We've
been able to role model really good inclusive practice, really good inclusive leadership, but also just a bit more intersectionality as well. And also within that, just, you know, because we don't have it that if someone's a member of Inspire feeling like, oh, well, I can only be in LGBT or I can only be here. The whole point is you can have interest in there, you can maybe support that area a bit more, but actually overall you'll support everything. And also with our work-life balance as well, and also our more flexible and agile working, you know, it's really good that that's been able to be discussed more and having that feedback with our colleagues, because I think in order for us to make good decisions, it's important to hear and get a good temperature check from our colleagues directly. And what they've achieved as a group in the last 2 years has just been immense, and I've just been amazed that a lot of these people were doing it initially as a sort of voluntary role on top of their day jobs.
So yeah.
The passion to be more inclusive and to build an inclusive environment here, quite literally here at Cushman & Wakefield, is brilliant to see, and it's great to be a part of.
Well, that is fantastic. That is a very positive note to kind of wrap up on. You've given us so much there, Lang. Thank you so much. I'm going to summarise it in the episode notes, all of your tips, because there was way more than 3, so thank you. But, you know, we had things in there about, I love this point that you started off on, you know, ask people how you like to be addressed. Let's just apply that to everybody. Thinking about the inclusive recruitment process, asking the right questions, particularly of your recruiters, developing a relationship with them so they understand your inclusion priorities. And there's 2 points around the data, well, there's more than 2, but there's 2 main points around the data. I think, firstly, this, be clear about why you're, the times when you are asking for gender information, because it may not always be relevant. And then this secondary point about bearing the global context in mind for data collection, and as you say so rightly, you know, that having the opt-out or preferred not to say option is, that needs to be in there, and that gives you that ability to apply some data collection globally. As you say, it's really important that you do know your people. And then we just touched upon making the most of your kind of external communications, your website. What face are you projecting to the world? Because linking back to all of that is, and across all of those points really, is data. And actually, as you so rightfully say, it's one thing having any kind of diversity policy, but let's take a trans inclusion policy for now. It's one thing having a policy like that, but how many people are you attracting into the business?
Yeah.
And measure that. because that's the only way you're going to know whether your policy is really being effective, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also, if off the back of a policy launch as well, particularly for transgender people, is there then a spike in people that are being more open about their identity at work? Because if it's been written in a way and also has other further maybe supporting documents that make it very clear about, from a colleague perspective, what to expect or what people can go through. But also, I think the other thing that I think I forgot to say on that I think is really, really critical is that there is good support for line managers in there, because actually the line manager is usually the first person that someone in effect will come out to. And I think it's really, really important that they are given a really, that they have materials, resources, and also people that they can actually interact with. Because, you know, I, in my career, for example, I have had some really heartwarming and just some amazing conversations with line managers who straight away, you know, luckily if there is a diversity and inclusion area, sometimes that is an area that I think is appropriate for a line manager to say, look, I want to get this right. What should I be doing? And some of the stories that I've heard back have just been so uplifting, because not only has someone done what was kind of, you know, sort of like what was expected, but some of them have gone really above and beyond in a way that I was like, wow, I'm amazed at the...
I've heard similar stories, and it just restores your faith in humanity, really.
Oh, it really does.
I mean, we are all, ultimately, we're all nice people. We don't fall out of bed in the morning as managers, aiming to make people's lives more difficult or emotionally hard.
If anyone wakes up going, you know what, I think I'm going to be a bit oppressive today.
Exactly.
You just don't have that mindset.
It's just, as you say, it's giving managers the tools so that they can do that with confidence. I 100% agree. Thank you so much, Lang. We're going to have to draw it to a close there. If people want to get in touch with you, I know you're active on Twitter. Now, remind me your Twitter handle.
It's at Langmonty.
Langmonty. And we can find you on LinkedIn. And I would urge everybody to go and get online and have a look at your TEDx talk as well, which is growing and growing in popularity. That was last summer, wasn't it?
Yes.
So you'll be able to find that with a quick Google search. Thank you so much. And look forward to continuing this conversation soon.
Great. So thank you for having me.
I hope this episode gave you some ideas that you can replicate in your own organisation. We'd love it if you could leave a review and also subscribe to Reworked so you don't miss our next episode. Diversity and inclusion at work has never been higher up the agenda. The EW Group team includes learning and development specialists, facilitators, researchers and analysts, all with deep expertise in equality, diversity and inclusion. If you think we can help you rework your own culture, please get in touch.